I have to say, cities would seem to be an odd subject for a physicist to study. So what can you, as a physicist, bring to our understanding of urban life that that an urban planner or an architect cannot?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And really, to answer that, I think you have to put cities in a bigger, more global context. And I think one way of viewing it is to recognize that urbanization has been taking place at this extraordinarily kind of exponential rate for the last couple of hundred years, so that we've gone from a few percent in the United States a couple of hundred years ago to over 80% now. The world has crossed the halfway mark, and we're adding 1.5 million people a week to cities across the globe. So this is quite extraordinary. So there's this huge challenge, even threat, I would say, to long-term sustainability.
So cities are basically becoming the way human beings live.
Exactly. We are, cities are us, so to speak. I mean, there's no question that cities have had the greatest impact, or at least let's put it slightly differently. The impact of human beings on the planet has probably been maximized by our urbanization that's been taking place in the last couple of hundred years, and especially during the last century and through now. And cities are the origin, if you like, of almost all of our so-called problems, the big challenges from the environment, global warming, questions of finance, risk, disease, pollution, energy, resources, all of these things. This tsunami of problems that we're facing are all generated in cities because that's where the people are. On the other hand, the solutions to the problems are also generated in cities because that's where the smart people are. That's where ideas, innovation, and wealth are generated. And so cities are the problem, but they're also the solution. So there's an urgency to having a theory of cities. So mm-hmm. The question is, now I'm coming to really answer your question.
What does a physicist have
exactly.
to say
about
this?
Exactly. Now I'm going to really come to answer your question is, in order to address those challenges, one would like to have a kind of science of cities, by which I mean, from a physicist viewpoint, having a kind of quantitative, predictive, analytic theory of cities. And the question is that possible? Or maybe that isn't possible at all, and we'll just have to stick with the traditional, more qualitative, narrative ways in which people have thought about cities.
So you actually want to come up with laws, general laws that apply to all cities.
So that's the question. Are there any generic, kind of universal, in quotes, laws that govern the growth, organization, and evolution of cities and their impact and coupling with the environment? Are there any? And that's a question. So the answer to that is important, whether it's yes or no. If it's no, that's a certain way of proceeding. If it's yes, there's another way of proceeding.
And I'm willing to bet that you're going to say yes.
And I'm obviously going to say yes, because otherwise you probably wouldn't be interviewing me here, maybe. So, one of the things that got me into this was I had asked similar questions with some biology colleagues some years ago about some big questions like that in biology. And the answer there was a yes. And they were stimulated by originally kind of phenomenological observations, by empirical laws that biologists had uncovered that are called scaling laws. And scaling laws are simply telling you how, if you scale up from, say, a mouse to an elephant, is there any regularity? And the extraordinary thing in biology is there is extraordinary regularity in that if you ask about any physiological quantity like metabolic rate or any life history event like how long do you live or how long does it take for you to mature, all of these things scale in a very systematic way following mathematical laws, but in a way that is kind of on the average, in a kind of coarse-grained way, so that on the average, you give me the size of a mammal, just take mammals, for example, you can say from those almost anything that's measurable physiologically or life in terms of life history event about that mammal of a given size. You tell me its weight. I can tell you, you know, the rate of diffusion of oxygen across some membrane, what its metabolic rate is, the length of its aorta, how much blood is flowing in the seventh branch of its arterial system, how long it will live, how many children it will have, etc. And from that, you have a kind of average quantitative theory, if you like, in a mathematical framework for generic behaviors of organisms. And the question is, can you do that for cities? So, in other words, if you think about organisms, what it says is that despite the fact that a whale lives in the ocean and a giraffe has a long neck and we walk on 2 feet and a mouse scurries around, we're actually at the kind of 85% level scaled versions of each other following these kind of nonlinear mathematical rules.
There are basic biological laws regarding size.
About size. And all of these, so the work that I was involved in, and this is very important when we come to cities, is that to ask when the hell did they come from? Why is it that there are these laws? And the answer that we had proposed, we meaning myself and colleagues Jim Brown and Brian Enquist, was that it was the generic universal mathematical properties, geometric topological properties of networks that sustain life, whether they are things like the circulatory system or the renal system or a neural system or networks within cells, whatever. But these are all networks that sustain life, transporting energy, resources, and information, and they satisfy certain mathematical constraints.
So take me to cities then. So what are some of these laws?
The first thing you realize is if that's true, that these extraordinary laws of biology are manifestations of underlying mathematics of networks, first thing you realize is cities, of course, are networks. They're networks of roads and distribution of energy, electricity, gas, etc. But they also have social networks. And the question is, what kind of laws, what kind of mathematics do they obey? And do they then translate into some extraordinary regularity among cities? So is New York a scaled-up San Francisco, which is a scaled-up Madison, which is a scaled-up Santa Fe? Even though they look completely different, they have different geography, history, and culture, but are they? Well, you can only answer that by looking at data. So the work that I got involved with a group of one major other physicist, Luis Bettencourt, colleague of mine, and some social scientists, was just looking at data and asking at various metrics that characterize cities, like the length of all its roads, the length of its electrical lines, the number of AIDS cases per year, the amount of violent crime, the GDP, the number of patents it produces, anything you could think of where you could get data. If you looked at that as a function of city size, is it kind of all over the place, just arbitrary, expressing that every city is really unique, which is the way it feels, or is there some regularity saying that even though it feels unique, it's actually behaving in a highly constrained, almost predictive way? And one of the things we discovered, which we were quite astonished by, actually, was that there was this extraordinary regularity. And that, indeed, to, again, this kind of 18 to 19% regularity, there were these commonalities across all cities, so that you tell me the size of a city in the United States, I can tell you with, 85% certainty how many police it has, the length of its roads, how many AIDS cases it, quote, should have, et cetera,
But on the other hand, we hear politicians periodically saying, there's too much crime here, right. So we're going to add to the police force.
Exactly.
So actually they do. They put a lot more police on the street. So it would seem like there actually are specific cases that would throw off your numbers.
So we have to now distinguish certain things. It turns out for most of these metrics, changing them is extraordinarily difficult. So there is this predictive power, but for example, let's take the length of all the roads. So that has a certain systematic behavior. But obviously, for that to change, or for politicians and planners to change it, that takes decades before the length of all the roads changes. Or if you take even the wages, the average wages, it takes decades for businesses to change and so on. But you take something like crime or even number of AIDS cases, you could imagine making changes on a much shorter timescale, just as you said. You could, if you realize that you're over or underperforming in terms of number of police you should have per capita, or the number of AIDS cases or flu cases per capita, you can make specific changes in 2 to 5 years that will have, potentially, will have important, profound effects. So, you know, there's a subtlety to this, and one has to dig deeper in terms of these individual metrics. But in the big picture, in the big kind of average picture, nevertheless, despite what I said, these things have extraordinary regular behavior.
Now, as we look at cities around the world, especially in developing countries, it seems like they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I guess I'm wondering if there's, from a physicist's perspective, is there an inherent reason why cities should get bigger? Is there some advantage to that?
Yes. So let me tell you a little bit about that, or what we think is going on there. So in biology, these scaling laws are such that, for example, what you might have expected is that if you had one mammal twice the size of another, it would require twice as much energy to stay alive. So you would have it had twice the metabolic rate. That's not the case at all. These scaling laws say, roughly speaking, that if it's twice the size, one is twice the size of the other, it actually only requires about 75%. So there's this extraordinary economy of scale. The bigger you are, the less energy each one of your cells needs per second to function, okay, in a systematic way. If you go to cities, you find there is a similarity to that in terms of infrastructure. That is, the bigger the city, the less infrastructure it needs per capita in a systematic way.
You don't need twice the number of
roads. You don't need twice the number of roads. You don't need twice the number of gas stations, twice the amount of electrical lines, and so on. The law there is roughly that it's about 15% saving. So there's this wonderful 15% saving in the collective of the city.
Each time you double the size.
Each time you double the size, you get this 15% saving. So that in a kind of collective way, there's this wonderful saving, this wonderful economy of scale, the bigger the city. Now, of course, that's not why people go to the city. You know, you don't choose the city because you think, my God, I'm going to save 15% for everybody. That obviously is not the case. But here's what is really interesting about cities. The infrastructure, in a certain sense, is the uninteresting part. It's like biology. It's, you know, it's the buildings and so on. The real city is sort of what we're doing. The interaction between people, the social networks, the clustering within those social networks, and the systematic structure of those networks.
And that's often why people move to cities.
And so people,
I mean, sometimes it's because there are more jobs there, but it's also because they seem like more vibrant places.
Exactly. So if you ask about these metrics that are associated with the social networks, so there's no analog of those in biology, like amount of wages you get, the number of AIDS cases, the number of patents produced, these kinds of things which are socioeconomic and involve the interaction between human beings, having to speak to one another, work together, create the buzz that is a city, etc. If you ask about those, you see a phenomenon which you do not see in biology in terms of its scaling, that if you double the size, instead of getting less of something, you get more. So if you double the size of a city, you get about 15% per capita increase of the wages, the average wealth, the number of AIDS cases, the number of patents produced, the number of police, the amount of crime, and so on, all coming together, scaling in the same way across the globe. So there's this kind of systematic behavior, which we believe is manifestations of the generic mathematical properties of the social networks that comprise the city. And those are the same across the globe because people are the same across the globe.
So even if you're talking about a city in China or in the U.S., I mean, I don't know, Shanghai compared to New York City, compared to Nairobi, you're saying they're sort of fundamentally operating on the same
principles?
So we
have to be careful here. So first of all, you have to compare. This comparison is within an urban system to begin with. So you're comparing all cities in the United States. They scale in a certain way for their infrastructure and their socioeconomic quantities. Then you look at all cities in China, you look at all cities in Portugal, in the UK, et cetera, et cetera. And you find that the scaling of those within those urban systems are pretty much the same. And that is this kind of 15% rule. 15% addition, value added, the bigger you are, value added meaning also things like crime and AIDS cases. However, the difference between urban systems, that is the difference between China and the United States, is an overall scale. So, for example, scaling of crime in Japan scales almost identically to the way crime scales in the United States. But the overall scale of crime is the thing that is Japanese and American, in the sense that the number of total number of crimes, violent crimes in Tokyo is, I don't know, I can't remember the numbers, but maybe even two orders of magnitude, a factor of 100 less than it is in New York. So that's a separate issue, which is then does represent something about the history and culture of the urban system. But the comparison between cities within an urban system is one that is universal. And so there's this. So now going back to your question, why is it that cities grow bigger? One could speculate that the reason is that people are attracted to cities because of this 15% added to, you know, all of the good things of life, the wages and the buzz of the city, you know, the number of theaters and the innovation represented, say, by patent production and so on.
Well, and there's also a very interesting question, which is, you know, for the planet, I mean, given that we have a population, a global population that is booming, there are real questions about whether the Earth can sustain this population. There are questions about whether the available energy resources can supply all of our human needs, whether large cities are good for us. I mean, is there actually an advantage? I mean, is high-density living basically the key to future human success?
Well, from this, if you extrapolate from this, the answer is, on the one hand, yes, because the bigger the city, the more you save per capita on everything you do, all this infrastructure. So if we insist on open-ended growth, which is the paradigm that we've bought into for the last couple of hundred years, the open-ended, exponentially rising economy, and concomitant with that, the open-ended exponential increase in population, if that were to continue, then putting people in bigger and bigger cities is a continuous way of saving. And so you save in the collective, but you gain at the individual level because the that increase of connectivity between people that is coming from increasing the network is leading to all of the good things of the city. Of course, what people are very happy to ignore are the concomitant bad things that come along with it, the crime and the AIDS cases and so on.
Well, there's also just the question of, can a city be too big to be livable? So, I mean, do you really want to live in a city of 30 million people?
Well, that's a very good question. And that's a question, of course, that is a little bit outside of this, because to ask the question, do you want to, is very hard to answer within a quantitative framework.
But that's crucial to our discussion. I mean, you're talking about well-being, the psychology of what it's like to live in a city.
So a big issue, of course, in social sciences is to quantify questions of things like happiness and well-being and contentment and so forth. This is not my area of expertise. I'm somewhat skeptical of those metrics. But independent of that, the evidence that people are continually attracted to cities because of this extraordinary increase in their well-being, despite the fact that they may even have to live for these periods in slums and favelas, nevertheless, is a continuous attraction of cities, like a huge magnet that is sucking people up. And I think there is this kind of image always that instead of struggling in the in the rural agricultural areas, that you can do much better in cities, and that's true. That is the truth. That it is the data strongly supports that and has supported it for the last couple of hundred years.
You can do better economically.
You can do better economically, and that seems to be the driving force. And it may even be that the underlying principle here is that people always want more. You know, and if that is the principle, then it follows that these cities will continue to grow. So one of the questions that's extremely interesting in this is that there are two interesting questions that are connected. One is there a maximum size for cities? You know, can they just kind of go on? Could you imagine a city of 100 million people? Well, the biggest city at the moment is Tokyo with 35 million, and there are many now so-called mega cities. Tokyo is somewhat unique that it's clearly a highly functioning, well-run city. Many of those other mega cities, especially in Africa and India, are kind of borderline because of these pressures. And I remind you of the statistic I said at the beginning, 1.5 million people a week. You realize what that is? That means that every 2 months, the equivalent to New York metropolitan area, not just New York City, New York metropolitan area is being added effectively to the planet. So that means, you know, between now and, I don't know, the beginning of December, there's another New York metropolitan area. By the beginning of February, another one, and so on for the next 25, 30 years. That's mind-blowing, actually. This makes me, I must say, quite cynical about our ability to cope with that. I mean, the stress on infrastructure, the stress on resources, energy, things like, you know, water, and so forth. And in the end, the stresses on the social fabric may actually be too much, that we simply can't sustain it.
Well, I mean, because what we haven't talked about is disparity in income.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have these mega cities where you have pockets of the super rich and then vast slums, that's a recipe for social explosion.
Exactly. And that's why I say my biggest concern, frankly, is the ultimate stress on social fabric, what I call social, that being manifested in this extraordinary discrepancy that you see between the very rich and the poor. And remarkably, you know, the United States, which is the richest country in the world, has one of the greatest divergences, and you know it's diverging at an extraordinary rate. And it's almost part of the inevitable dynamic of where we are in this. So one of the interesting things about cities that differs from biology that is related to this is that in biology, the kind of scaling where you have this economy of scale, which we call sublinear scaling, you double the size, you get less than a linear response to the system. You get about a 75% response, leads to growth that is stable. That is, like us, you grow quickly, and then at some stage you stop, even though you go on eating. You know, it's kind of amazing, actually. You know, why is it that you, if you eat until you're about 18, you keep growing in the ontogenetic sense? You may, of course, when you're our age, my age anyway, continue to grow on the horizontally, but you stop growing in the biological sense, and that is intimately related to this sublinear behavior, this economy of scale. And it is also related to the fact that the bigger you are, the pace of life slows down. So elephants, everything in an elephant moves slower than it does for a mouse. Hearts beat slower, etc. Now you go over to cities, and we talked about growth and growing to mega cities. So first, if you go back, so cities are a quintessential socioeconomic system. And if they were biological in the sense I just described, we would consider that a disaster because we believe in an open-ended, exponentially rising economy. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, one of the things that always amuses me is that, you know, when every quarter when they announce the GDP rate and they say, you know, everybody hopes that it's going to be 3 or 4%. And they announce that it's only 1.5 or 2%, as if that's some great tragedy, is that the extraordinary thing about it, first of all, the population didn't grow at 1.5 or 2%, let alone 4%. And furthermore, even if it's 1%, it still is exponential. So that is kind of in the DNA of our socioeconomic system, that we must be expanding exponentially. So that's very bad if we were biological. So if you now go over to cities and socioeconomic systems where we see this superlinear behavior, the bigger you are, the more you have per capita, that translates in terms of growth into something that's very satisfactory from a theoretical viewpoint it actually predicts that you have open-ended growth. So superlinear behavior is tied to open-ended growth, which is what we love, apparently.
Is that to say that cities could just keep expanding? Well, you could have 100 million inhabitants in a city?
Well, that's a question opened for discussion because, yes, in one way the answer is yes. On the other, my own view of this, this is actually work that we're doing with various collaborators, particularly people at NYU, which has a big bunch of urban planners and urban center, is this very question, is there any stopping of maximum size? And it may well be that it ends up being infrastructure, because in this, there are two things, really. The definition of a city is obviously one of that is questionable. What is a city? You know, is it just all the buildings? Where does it end? And so forth. So in this framework, roughly speaking, it is everybody that's somehow connected to the network. Now, that still isn't well defined, but it has a better defined meaning that you are part of the network of Madison in some way. That's the idea. So there is a definition in the United States called a metropolitan statistical area, which roughly corresponds to that. So the question is, could this network grow to encompass 100 million people and at the same time have an infrastructural network that still functions? Well, my own feeling is that that may be unlikely because take Los Angeles. We already have, that's a city of only, in quotes, maybe 15 million people. But it already has, 12-lane freeways going through.
There are only so many lanes you can
so
add
then
to
the
a freeway.
Exactly. So that brings the question, if you have 100 million people and you want them all to be part of this network and we still have the same transportation system, so we, maybe that will change. But if we did, with the same, the same kind of way in which we move around, we're going to have, 25-lane freeways, to make it absurd, maybe. That is clearly impossible, I would say. I think that's very unlikely. So it could be that there's a stopping of cities or that cities do what you already see happening in some places, that they bifurcate or they disintegrate, they balkanize in some way.
They split into two or three cities.
Even though they're contiguous, rather than the old model where two cities close to one another amalgamate and join, you have the opposite phenomenon may occur, that they kind of fission, even though they're still connected, but effectively the networks break up. So this is a question open to, speculation and research, which...
So here you are, the physicist who studies cities.
Yes.
You're gathering all kinds of data. You're coming up with general laws as to how cities work. Are there policy implications here? Should urban planners be listening to what you're coming up with?
Yes. A very good question, and a question we ponder quite a bit. So one of the things that has been gratifying about the work, is that many urban planners, architects, policymakers have talked to us quite a bit, and there's a great deal of interest. And my view of this is that, first of all, I take a kind of philosophical view that knowledge and understanding is always important, that, we wouldn't have the extraordinary society we are in, the kind of standard and quality of life, unless we'd understood everything from, Newton's laws to Maxwell's laws, even relativity, may I say, but thinking of as a physicist, but all the multiple kind of underlying science that this leads to. We wouldn't have the kind of technology we have. We wouldn't have, our iPhones and iPads and our kind of automobiles we have without that kind of underlying science. So it is, I believe, with cities. So here's my kind of little cartoon version. To build an airplane, you don't have to know any science, actually. You don't really have to know deep principles, probably, of engineering. But you have to have very good intuition, and you have to be a very good tinkerer. And that's what the Wright brothers were, in a sense. I'm maybe paraphrasing a little bit. But they were extraordinary. They were able to work, kind of symbolically in the back garage and put together an airplane that flew and revolutionized the planet. And they did not have to know the laws of aerodynamics and hydrodynamics, the physics of materials and so on. Wonderful. But you try building a Boeing 747 not knowing hydrodynamics, mm-hmm. aerodynamics, and materials and so on. So you can't scale unless you understand. And scale is critical for the resilience, growth, and evolution of any adaptive system, and in particular of cities. So I would say, to be quite provocative about it, I think in many ways we are dealing with cities, both in terms of policy and practicalities, much as if we're Wright brothers.
As opposed to designing the Boeing 747.
Understanding, yes, and asking. I mean, it may be that, you know, you can only take this kind of view, this scientific view, in quotes, so far. I don't know. But what it desperately needs is to develop that science, to have the underlying theories, the predictive power of them, and at the same time, in parallel, bring them together with the traditional, more qualitative, narrative way of thinking about them, because there's no question that, you know, the people have been thinking about cities, after all, since the Greeks. But there's been, you know, huge literature on cities, the famous work of, you know, Lewis Mumford and Jane Jacobs and others, that is much more qualitative and narrative, but tremendously insightful.
Well, to make this more concrete, it would seem that one obvious conclusion to what you're saying is, as especially for the big cities, you need a really good mass transit system.
For example, you
can't keep building highways that have 12 lanes and then 20 lanes. That just becomes unsustainable. You have to figure out more efficient ways for people to get from point A to point B.
Yes, and you need to think about it in a systemic way. I mean, it has to be, it can't be done piecemeal and locally. There are some local issues that need to be addressed, obviously. But overall, you need to think systemically and to understand what the underlying laws are and what it is that's driving them. And what is driving them is the social networks, the interaction of people. Cities are people. They're not the roads and the buildings and so on. Of course, they are. But underlying them are the interaction of people, and a successful city has somehow been able to facilitate the multiple interactions that give rise to the buzz, the excitement, and the kind of facilitating the creativity of a city.
So how do you do that? I mean, does that just happen, or can you actually plan for that?
Well, I think you can understand some of that. So one of the things that we did, just to start down this road and asking these kinds of questions that could lead to policy, was we looked at the scaling laws. So the scaling laws say, as I said earlier, give me the size of the city. It says you should have, you know, this many police, you should be producing this many patents, you should have this much crime, this many AIDS cases, okay, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, when you look at each individual city, you see that it violates each one of these. It either over or underperforms relative to, quote, what it should be doing according to the idealized situation given by the social networks and the scaling laws. So what we did is we took data from the 366 metropolitan statistical areas of the United States. So they're the 366 biggest cities, beginning with New York, all the way down to cities the size of what I live in and smaller, to about 50,000. And we looked and asked, how do they perform relative to how they should? What are they over or underperforming? And that then gives you what we maybe arrogantly call a science-based metric for how good you're doing, and asking, what is it that you're doing in that city that has led to you either being lousy? You know, you're hardly producing any patents relative to what you should, or you're having more crime than you should, or you're overperforming. So just to take a somewhat trivial example, when we looked at patents, we discovered that the city that is overperforming relative to its size is Corvallis, Oregon. I think, gee whiz, why Corvallis, Oregon?
There's a university there.
Of course, there's a university. Oregon State is there, but also there's a big Hewlett-Packard research lab. Well, this is a trivial thing in a way. But then you would dig deeper and ask, what is it about the DNA of Corvallis, of what the city is doing in facilitating that, in the same way that when we looked at San Jose. So San Jose is, of course, in the top four of patent producers because of Silicon Valley. San Jose includes Silicon Valley. And you say, well, that's obvious because of Silicon Valley. But here's what's interesting is we look back at data as far back as you can actually get it, which is to about the 60s. So it's about 50-odd years or so, 50, 60 years. And what you found is that what we found is that Silicon Valley, San Jose was overperforming before Silicon Valley.
There's a reason that Silicon Valley was...
Exactly. It's not an arbitrary thing. It's not just because Stanford is there, for example. There's something more to it than that. And one of the most interesting things about these kinds of data was that if a city is overperforming, was overperforming in, say, 1960, 1970 to a certain degree, roughly speaking, it's over or underperforming to the same degree now. So there's extraordinary. So on the one hand, that's good because there's extraordinary resilience and stability in the city. On the other hand, it tells you something very important for planners, that it's very hard to change things on a big scale.
So to take the San Jose example, what were they doing right back in the 1960s and 70s?
So that's now part of our ongoing research, is to go dig deeper into this. And what we would like to do ultimately is to turn some of that over to our social science colleagues, because that requires digging deeper into, first of all, the history of, say, the San Jose area, to go through interviews and so forth, to get data on what was happening in San Jose, and maybe most, in many ways, most importantly, what were the kind of social structures that led to this? What was it about the social structures, from the political to just the kinds of people that were moving in and forming the kinds of businesses they have? Because one of the other things that we discovered more recently was that a critical element of a city is its diversity. And diversity here means primarily, in this context, means diversity of businesses and jobs. And again, what we found was that there is an extraordinary regularity to the way in which diversity increases as you increase the size of the city, and leading to its greater and greater success. So that as the city grows, it's part of the reason for that growth is the increase in its dimensionality, that it's open to more and more different kinds of businesses and so forth. And just to bring something else into this, this is in marked contrast typically to companies, which tend to go the other way. They tend to become lower and lower dimensional, becoming almost unidimensional in some cases, making themselves very vulnerable to changes in the environment. They're not easily adaptable. They don't easily evolve, whereas cities are extraordinary because of this opening of diversity, being very open to change and new things. And cities that do more of that tend to be more successful. And I think there's a huge lesson in that. And so, but having said that, we have not done the research to dig deeper. So, and one thing you should understand, Santa Fe Institute is a small institution. We have a small group. We have tentacles all over the place. And this has opened up huge vistas. And as you said at the beginning, I come as a physicist.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time.
Yeah.
One final question. If there's one question out there you wish you could answer regarding cities, you as the physicist, you know,
yes,
trying to figure out how cities work, you know, what makes the best, the most livable city, what would that one question be? What's the question that needs to be answered?
Well, the question that that drives this for me is the one that we've touched on. Actually, is any of this sustainable? Cities are the manifestation of who we are. They represent the best of human achievement in many ways and some of its worst aspects, but they continue to grow and dominate the planet. They've had the biggest impact on the planet in the history of human beings. But it's not clear to me at all that they're sustainable. So the question, in a certain sense, is life has been around for 2 to 3 billion years. Socioeconomic human beings, cities, maximally been around 10,000 years. So the question really is this just some wonderful diabolic experiment that we participated in that's going to last on the order of 10,000 years, and we're going to go back to being biological? Or are we going to continue in our magnificent progression? But what is clear to me is that we cannot do it with the kind of open-ended exponential growth that we have, because I think any physicist knows that you cannot sustain exponential growth ad infinitum.
The planet simply cannot sustain the growing population with the energy that is required.
I consider myself a neo-Malthusian. That is that there is a limit, and it doesn't matter how often you innovate, how many wonderful innovations you make. It's you can't do them fast enough to sustain the pace at which we are driving the system.
So that's a sobering thought to end it on. So
that's
crash.
The question. That's the question. That's the question. Actually, in terms of a question, is that right or wrong?
I know there are some urban planners who say it's too much to look at a city as a whole. That if you're actually going to make useful changes, you have to target specific things. Some people have used this phrase, urban acupuncture. Yeah, right. Are there specifics that you would look at that that people should focus on?
Well, in a certain sense, I'm not competent to answer that, to be honest. We've looked at this in the big picture. We've looked at it, in this kind of a systemic way. And I believe that it produced results and questions that surprised me and were so big that they've kind of dominated my thought. One of the things that we are beginning to do is to come to that question that you've just raised by digging deeper into cities, because we've considered cities primarily in an average sense, but dig deeper and ask questions about the questions of the business area, the question of the suburbs, the business of the poor areas or slums and so on, and ask, are there any regularities there, any things we can understand there so that we can do what has been suggested by various planners, target certain areas. I'm agnostic on that. And one of the reasons that we're having problems is that it's hard to get data. I mean, this is a huge question. It was not so difficult to get some of the data I've referred to earlier on the kind of average sense, but people have not been very good at taking systematic data for these kind of deconstructed focused areas across urban systems so that you can ask, are there any kind of underlying dynamics that is common that we can start really applying more conceptual ideas to dealing with them rather than being totally dominated by local way of thinking. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't have that. In fact, I believe very strongly you need to have that, but you need to integrate these. So the problem that we have faced is getting local data. Now, we might be able to get some of that via census and so on, but it takes enormous amount of person power to be able to do that. So I'm agnostic on how much one want, what one can achieve with that. Certainly I agree that we need to integrate that into this.
Certainly one of the most influential thinkers about cities over the past century was Jane Jacobs. And one of her ideas was that the city works like an organism. Yeah. Do you think she's basically right?
Well, as I said earlier, I got into this because, with my colleagues had developed a kind of big picture theory of organisms based on networks. And it was very natural to take that over to cities. And I don't think I'd even heard of Jane Jacobs when I began this work, which is kind of astonishing. And since then I've become, of course, obviously like many other people, a great admirer of her work. So I came with the view that it was just like an organism. And in fact, in the first proposal I ever wrote, and it was funded with some social science colleagues, actually, that was part of what it was about. And in fact, I had all kinds of statements in there that basically said it was an organism, it would grow like an organism, and so on, which turned out to be wrong. And so in answer to that question, to some extent, a city is an organism. It has many, many things, metaphorically, certainly, that are like organisms. It grows, it adapts, it evolves, it is a network structure, et cetera, et cetera. However, its infrastructure behaves very, very similarly to our infrastructure. It's slightly different in the sense, quantitatively, instead of having a 25% rule, a quarter power rule, what we call a quarter power rule, it has a 15% rule. So you have these wonderful economies of scale of infrastructure. However, in the very thing that is a city and the very thing that Jane Jacobs emphasized and kept beating on economists and planners, the city is people. And it turns out the people side of the equation is not like organisms. A new dynamic was introduced to the planet, possibly even to the universe, for all we know, when people started talking to one another and working together, discovering economies of scale, but then, more importantly, being innovative. And by being innovative and producing ideas and therefore wealth, we changed the planet. And that was this superlinear behavior, which you don't see in biology, and something that manifests a dynamic to do with the social network underpinnings, which has some things in common with biology, but it has this essential difference that you get more per capita than less per capita, and that leads to this extraordinary open-ended growth, which is the thing that we love, but also may be taking us over the edge of a cliff. And something I didn't talk about, it also is the origin of our speeding up of the pace of our lives. Our life gets faster because of this superlinear behavior and because of this structure of the network in a systematic way, so that living in a bigger city, everything moves faster systematically, but also in terms of the bigger evolution of the system, you have to innovate faster and faster to keep up with things in a systematic way. And that ultimately, if we stay with the same paradigm, may lead to our demise. Hopefully not. And hopefully we need to change. So going back to some of your early questions, one of the questions is there an alternative to growth? Or maybe put it slightly differently, maybe we simply need to define growth differently. And it goes back to your question of growth of, you know, why do you want to come to a city? Growth of, I'll use the platitude of happiness or contentment or whatever it is that we human beings want and need as spiritual, you know, sensuous human beings. So I think that's a big issue.